One South Florida lawmaker is taking on conversion therapy. Will she find support in the Republican legislature? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Democratic State Senator Tina Pawlowski is pushing forward a bill to ban conversion therapy, the controversial practice that has been shown to cause damage to young LGBTQ teens. We'll ask her about the recent court case allowing it and hear the legislature's plan for tackling COVID. Also,
it's almost impossible to not know about the Villages if you live in Florida. It's like you'd have to be living under a rock.
We'll talk with the director of the new documentary, Some Kind of Heaven, a look into the world inside the largest retirement community in the U.S. And finally, Shelby Rassler's music career started in South Florida. We'll talk to the local kid who got to put together one of the most important songs of the recent inauguration. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The Florida Department of Health released preliminary data on vaccinations for the state, and some of those findings might shock you. For one, nearly 40,000 out-of-staters have already received their first shot. That's more than Lee, Brevard, and Sarasota counties. Governor Ron DeSantis has defended the vaccinations of snowbirds, saying they're just as likely to fill up hospitals here and spread the virus as locals. Furthermore, there have been controversial stories about wealthy donors that have been able to cut the line. How will lawmakers tackle this issue in the session that's barely a few weeks away? Democratic Senator Tina Pawlowski represents Palm Beach County. Her district is based in Boca Raton. Senator Pawlowski, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Let me start with this. Let's talk about the vaccines first and the rollout in Palm Beach County. As of last Thursday, more than 100,000 residents had received the vaccine. That is the second highest for any county in the state. But what are you hearing from constituents about access and scheduling and just getting that first shot?
It's been really difficult, as you know, and I'm glad that so many people have been vaccinated. But you can imagine how many people have not and the frustration that they're feeling, especially the senior community with what is involved with getting an appointment. You know, the people who are successful have five tabs open on several devices and multiple people helping them to try to get an online appointment. So that is making, you know, many seniors frustrated. We are eventually going to a phone system. Broward has gone to a phone appointment system, which I think will be very helpful. They were one of the first to go to the new state system. Palm Beach County is not there yet, but it's very difficult. And let me just tell your listeners right out that Wednesday morning, 6 a.m., Publix is opening up its appointment system again. Again, you know, it's going to require a little computer skills, but, you know, at least that there's some available. And because Publix has such a robust program, then the Department of Health doesn't have as many. But what I can assure your listeners is that if you had signed up via email, which was this funny email address that the Palm Beach County Department of Health was giving out, that you were on a list and they're working their way through that list. And I have heard many people getting those phone calls or emails back from the county and then setting up appointments in John Prince Park or in South County Civic Center in Delray. Those seem to be the locations.
Yeah.
So it is happening. It's just obviously happening a lot slower than people would like. And there is a lot of confusion.
And you talked about Publix. Those are the Publixes in Palm Beach County.
Correct. I believe every Publix that has a pharmacy in Palm Beach County is a location. So I understand it to be 67 of those.
Yeah.
And it's not available in other counties, but for some reason, Palm Beach got almost all their Publixes to be able to have the vaccine. And I did hear that there will be further rollout, perhaps with Walmart or Winn-Dixie, you know, as time goes on or relatively soon.
And then, of course, you know, as I mentioned, you have stories like, you know, people coming in from out of town, out of the country to get their shots. Wealthy donors cutting in line. You had the controversy with Morse Life Health in West Palm Beach, reported giving the vaccine to its board members and wealthy donors. How do you ensure, you know, equitable distribution in a time like this?
Well, that was, you know, either a real oversight or just, you know, incompetence that we allowed that to happen. There has been a change where you have to be a Florida resident. So those making new appointments will have to prove Florida residency in order to get the shot at this time. But some of the appointments that have already been scheduled, that even if they're not a Florida resident, they're going to let those people go through because they did have their appointments. So going forward, we should not have that problem with people who don't live here.
Right.
As far as donors and hospitals, you know, that was, again, part of the executive order, was that hospitals were our first distribution center. And that's changed because either they couldn't handle it or, you know, it wasn't going the way you know, the governor liked that it was going, and it was causing a lot of confusion again. So that's why there was a switch to the state health department via each county, and then now third-party partners like Publix.
Yeah, I want to clarify, and I have to mention, by the way, as a disclaimer, that Morris Life is an underwriter for WLRN. Now let's come back to this, you know, how the distribution is supposed to work. And look, one, we hear the president say now he's going to, you know, he has a plan for 100 million people to be vaccinated in the first 100 days. You know, we have the governor now, you know, just saying that we have these third parties that are handling it, from CVS to Publix to whatever. I mean, who really in the state of Florida is in charge of this? If I wanted to know more, if I wanted to get information about when am I going to get it, is it the governor? Is it the Florida Department of Health? Or am I just waiting for my local supermarket pharmacy to be able to open up and I can get on the list?
I would say that the best source of information is the Florida Department of Health. And when you hear about Hard Rock having a bunch of, you know, locations and various other places, that's all done through the Department of Health. So it's not the actual county, but each county has a Department of Health located within it. And they're the ones who are distributing vaccines. When I talked about before, if you signed up for the email in Palm Beach and you're getting a call to go get your vaccine, that's done through the Florida Department of Health, Palm Beach County Division. The governor set up the paradigm. So just to tie back in for a second with the hospitals, he left it open for hospitals to vaccinate their employees, which is the right thing to do. People who are under their care, which I agree is the right thing to do. And then the community, 65 and older. But I think by leaving open employees, I'm not exactly sure of the wording, but there was an opportunity to get board members. And it was sort of the hospital's discretion. And so that's why I think some of that happened.
And but, is it that the state then is just waiting for the doses, you know, the you know, a larger amount of doses to be available that's coming from the federal government?
Well, that's for sure. I mean, I know that we have the infrastructure set up all over the place to distribute many more vaccines if we were given more quantity. But I think that I wish we wouldn't see any kind of issue between the governor and the president as to getting the vaccines. But I think the ultimate decision maker for Florida is going to be the governor.
Yeah.
But the federal government is supplying those vaccines. And, you know, there was already some controversy where the president said, you know, we'll distribute this through FEMA, who obviously know what they're doing. You know, in an emergency, they get out there and do their distributions of food and water, et cetera. So they know what they're doing, but already our governor has said that he's not interested in their help and we don't need their help. We just need more supply.
Right.
Now, that's true that we need more supply, but I certainly don't think he should be turning down any support. And if FEMA wants to set up shop, that's just one more distribution center. So, but I do think the way our government is set up, that the governor really does have the control. For example, he's the one who said 65 and older. He'll be the one to say, okay, we're ready for the next tranche of people
move
to be
the next phase, right?
Teachers, it's the immunocompromised or whatever it's going
to
be.
Right. Let me move to the Florida House and Senate have filed companion bills to protect businesses from liability claims due to COVID-19. And that could be, I mean, it could be a dangerous precedent, you know, because if you have, for example, nursing homes, assisted living facilities protected from lawsuits, even if they're inadequate care. I wanted to know your take on this. Is this something you would vote for? How do you protect businesses, but at the same time, protect the residents?
Well, it's a very timely question you ask, because an exactly an hour, I'm going to my Judiciary Committee meeting where we are hearing the COVID bill for the first time in the Senate side. It was heard on the House and obviously, you know, passed through that committee. And this bill will pass too because of the Republican majority. But I do have a problem with the bill in its current form. I'm not opposed to the idea of protecting businesses, but I want it done in the proper judicial framework. And this bill, there's a bunch of technicalities to it, but basically it creates such barriers to the judicial system for an individual who believes that a business has not taken the proper precautions and they believe that they got COVID there. This does not include nursing homes or hospitals. They carve that out. That will be a separate bill at some point because that is a unique circumstance. Employees also bring their claims through workers' compensation. So what we're really talking about here is a narrow group of customers who believe that they...
Well, how about... Let me do, because you said nursing homes and hospitals, that's a whole nother sector. But let's say, for example, one of the things that we saw early on with this pandemic is... supermarket workers. Supermarkets were considered, I mean, you know, a very important business that had to stay open. But there were workers claiming that, you know what, I don't think my employer is doing enough to protect me. So how would this play out in a situation like that? Could a worker, you know, or even a customer at a store say, you know, I don't feel like that store did enough. I want to sue them for that because I got COVID or somebody in my family got COVID when they visited there.
So I think for the customer, when this bill is all said and done, which I think it's going to have some changes along the way, I certainly hope, the customer would have to prove somehow that they got COVID at that location. And you can imagine how difficult that is if you're a customer and, you know, you've been out anywhere except Publix, just to take an example. So yeah. That's the big issue with this legislation and kind of my position on it is that... it's very difficult to prove. There are not a lot of lawsuits now.
Right.
There will not be a lot of lawsuits because most lawyers understand it's very difficult to prove causation and they're not going to bring the case. So I think this bill is creating what we call a solution where there's no problem. I don't believe that there's a rash of COVID cases from customers. Now, employees is a little bit of a different story. They have to go through workers' compensation. There is a one case though right now for Publix that is in court because the person died who was working in the deli counter. And when you have something very serious, this person, a wrongful death suit, then you can go beyond workers' comp and go into a regular court of law to get, you know, like on a negligence theory. So that's what they're trying to deal with here is this negligence theory, but they're putting up such blockades that, you know, you still need proper access to the judicial system.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think this bill with the right compromises and one that I'm suggesting is you have to prove you had COVID and you have to prove it was serious, not just that you had COVID, but that you had real damages resulting from it. And then perhaps you can sue. But I don't like the way that they have set it up now. It's almost impossible for anyone. And I think the important point is that businesses do everything they can to secure the safety of the customers and employees. And we want to encourage that behavior, not discourage that behavior with immunity.
And I'm talking again with Democratic State Senator Tina Pawlowski in Palm Beach County, talking about the legislative response to the coronavirus pandemic and, of course, vaccines and how, when and how the state will get more vaccines and how more people in Florida can get their vaccines. And again, if you live in Palm Beach County, we want to hear from you. You can share your thoughts on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I want to shift gears here, Senator. The other issue that I wanted to talk to you about is the very controversial gay conversion therapy. The practice was banned across South Florida, numerous communities. Those bans have been lifted by a court decision. What do you understand briefly about this therapy and what it entails?
So I haven't, you know, gone through anything like that myself, but from what I understand, you know, there are individual therapists who try to convince people through different methods that, you know, their inclination towards being gay is wrong, morally wrong, and they, you know, through very abusive techniques, try to convince them to...
Do you know anyone who's gone through it?
I'm sorry?
Do you know anyone who's gone through it?
Not personally, no, but okay. I am in not that anyone's told me. I am in touch with various advocacy groups who represent people who perhaps have gone through it. But, you know, I hear through them, you know, how awful this practice is. And so what happened was, for example, the city of Boca Raton, which is this famous case right now, banned it and banned this practice of conversion therapy. And the Court of Appeals for our area, the 11th Circuit, ruled it unconstitutional because it's a therapist speaking and they deemed it free speech.
Right.
So what my colleague, Representative Grieco, and I put forth in the legislature just last week was a bill to continue to ban conversion therapy, but we tried to work around the 11th Circuit opinion. If we just put in, you know, we want to ban conversion therapy, which has been proposed several years, of course, never got a hearing, then they might just very easily say, well, sorry, the court ruled on it. We're not hearing your bill. So we tried to come up with a little bit more creative way of going about it. Because they focus on First Amendment speech, we wanted to make sure that our bill bans any kind of physical components of this conversion therapy, as well as banning advertising for these therapists or and, whoever they are.
And it's not just the First Amendment issue. The other thing, you have religious organizations that are running these conversion therapy programs, and they're going to argue their First Amendment rights, but that it's a form of religious discrimination. How do you dance around that?
Well, our bill does not deal with that, but, you know, then they're getting into the practice, a religious organization is getting into the practice of therapy, which is illegal. So, you know, you can't practice law without a degree. You can't give therapy without a degree. So I would kind of go at that angle. And, you know, just I believe that these advocacy organizations are still fighting this in court and they believe that this decision is wrong and they're asking for further hearings on it. So we'll see what comes down. I understand the argument, but the end result is this abusive practice is allowed to go on, and
Do you have,
it's
do you,
very dangerous.
Do you think you have the support, though, I mean, considering the House, the Senate, the executive branch, the judicial branch in Tallahassee, it's all red. Do you think you can get the support there?
I think it's going to be a very uphill battle. They've never heard the bill before this court case happened. They don't tend to hear these kinds of bills, but that doesn't mean we don't bring them forward because, you know, we never give up and we make sure that everyone's rights are heard and including, you know, those of the LGBTQ community. And this is a terrible practice. And so it should be banned statewide. And this way we don't have to worry about court decisions and we just make it an act of legislation so that practitioners know, religious organizations know, parents know, this is not something that's acceptable.
And just, we have to... Just to remind people, your bill isn't banning the practice altogether. It's just you're trying to attack certain parts of it.
That's correct, because right now we're under the jurisdiction of the 11th Circuit decision. But if that decision is reversed or, you know, changed in any way, then we can come back next year and do something a little bit different.
All right. Well, it's one of the many that we will follow. Again, the session starting up in March, so we're barely a month away. I want to thank Democratic State Senator Tina Pawlenty from Palm Beach County. Senator, thank you so much for the time.
You're very welcome. Have a good afternoon.
All right. Well, still to come, a new documentary film exploring life in the villages, drugs, sex, romance, and pickleball. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, reaching our golden years, that's something a lot of us think about from time to time. A new documentary explores what it means to feel younger as you get older.
You're not going to be tomorrow the same age you are today. So think about you.
You come here to live. You don't come here to pass away. You don't need to go outside the villages. You would never have to leave.
Well, the Villages is America's biggest retirement community, and its residents are the subjects of the new film, Some Kind of Heaven. We spoke with director Lance Oppenheim about the time that he spent in this unique community just northwest of Orlando. Let's start with this, Lance. You grew up in Fort Lauderdale, and I'm wondering, what did you know about the Villages before you started working on this project?
So, you know, I mean, I'm sure like many people who live in Florida, you know, knowing about the, I feel like it's almost impossible to not know about the Villages if you live in Florida. It's like you'd have to be living under a rock. You know, when I had first heard about the Villages, I must have been in middle school. And I had heard of it as, you know, I think on slow news days, local newspapers in South Florida would republish articles that came from up north, and specifically stuff that was talking about like the more hedonistic activities that went on, you know, in the Villages. So stuff that related to, you know, this supposedly high STD rate that was traveling around. There was another story I remember reading about how two seniors had been arrested for having sex in public. When I was growing up, it was almost treated as more of the punchline of a joke. It didn't seem like people were treating it as seriously. And then it was only until I left Florida and I was in college in Boston that I started thinking about it again. I saw an article that had written, you know, that essentially had a statistic that had said that the Villages had become one of the fastest growing cities in America, not just retirement communities in America, but cities. And that 130,000 people were now living in this kind of palm fringed Truman Show like utopian society. And I knew I had to go down and, you know, I was interested in making films about people who are chasing, you know, or trying to live inside of a fantasy, with the consequences of what that fantasy kind of has on the other side.
Yeah. You said it. If you live in Florida for any amount of time, you're going to find out what the Villages, at least that it exists. You know, it's hard not to know about it. But, you know, tell us a little bit about, this is a fascinating history. Tell us a little bit about Harold Schwartz and this vision that he had for this Disney world for older adults.
Yeah, well, you know, I think this is one of the things that fascinated me so much about the place and made me want to go make a film about it, really, was the way in which this community presents itself with a history that stretches back, you know, far into the times of like Juan Ponce de Leon finding the Fountain of Youth, supposedly. But really, you know, the community's only been really around since the 80s. And it started off as a trailer park. It was the vision of a very intelligent man who had bought a lot of cheap land in Orlando, or kind of on the outskirts of Orlando. Very much inspired by Disney. And he had a vision for what the baby boomers would want to do when they would come to retire. And his vision was to make what he calls the Disney World for retirees. You know, and what that meant was hiring Imagineers to help him concoct these three town squares that all have their own specific, unique, fake history, you know. And what was once this trailer park, a mobile home community that was very modest, became suddenly this much larger, broader vision, this kind of retirement mecca. So it really is this complete artificial reconstruction of this American vision that maybe never quite existed fully. You know, it really kind of resembles a lot of the images that you'd find in like a Ronald Reagan, you know, Morning in America commercial.
Let's look at some of the characters you follow. Really interesting characters. And they kind of really give us this idea of the complexity of the residents who live there. You have, for example, Annie and Reggie Kintzer look like a happily married couple. But we learn that, you know, Reggie is dealing with a drug addiction and Annie is unhappy in the marriage. How do you build a relationship with folks like this so that they let you into their lives and share such intimate information with you?
It's not easy. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I guess it's look, I think, you know, one part of making a film is that you really have to know when you turn off the camera and you still continue to exist in your subjects' lives. And in this case, you know, I spent a few months without a camera. When I first got to the Villages, I rented a Airbnb that I found online. I lived with these two retired rodeo clowns in this rented room. And I kind of just went around town trying to meet as many people as possible and hearing people's stories. And I stuck out like a sore thumb, for one, because I was a few generations younger than the folks who were there. But there was this interesting leveling effect that happened where, you know, I was a senior in college when I started making this film, and I was in my own sort of form of a Peter Pan syndrome. I didn't want to graduate. I didn't want to leave. I was having the best time of my life. And here was a whole group of people in some ways. You know, one of the sales pitches of the Villages is that it does kind of bring you back to college. It does return you back to this time where, you know, you didn't have as many responsibilities. You could go to as many clubs as you wanted. You could party all the time. I was almost the very age that a lot of folks were attempting to return back to, which I think in some ways allowed me to maybe a little bit of an older journalist or outsider. I'm not sure if they would have been able to get quite the first impression that I made on some people, which was really, whose grandkid is this? And then I would kind of explain what I was there to do. And then suddenly it was almost like this much realer connection was made. And, you know, to me, what was important about making this film was I didn't want to make a film about older people. I wanted to make a film about people and people who had desires that, you know, were going unfulfilled and love that was unrequited and all the things that you may be able to find in like a John Hughes movie, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or, you know, you look back at the films that he made. And I thought here is almost the same exact, a lot of the same themes, but it's happening, you know, in the final few chapters of life, which I thought was kind of fascinating. But, you know, we had a lot of meals together, a lot of, you know, we'd have wine, we'd talk. Because we shot this film in a relatively stylized manner and it was all shot on tripod, you know, that also dictated kind of a level of how in which we could work together. It forced, you know, me to be much more upfront about how I was capturing a specific moment because we weren't flies on the wall, because sometimes moments would have to be recaptured or recreated. It required us to kind of let them know what exactly the focus or the lens of the production was at all times. Yeah. So that, I think, in some ways actually instilled a level of deeper trust that we was kind of mutually fostered. And then, you know, that continued on into, you know, when we were editing the film.
I'm speaking with Lance Oppenheim, director of the new film, Some Kind of Heaven. The film is available through local independent theaters, as well as Amazon Prime, Google Play, and iTunes. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to ask you about Dennis Dean. This guy, I mean, self-described gold digger. Is that, I don't know if that's fair to say, that he was living in a van and looking for some widow to meet up with, to hook up with. When and how did you meet Dennis?
I met Dennis at a singles club and he was masquerading as a Villages resident. And he gave me a business card that said celebrity handyman and personal companion for hire. And you know, in the Villages, a lot of people use business cards. It's almost like old school Facebook. So I thought at first he was making a joke and I wasn't quite sure who he was or what he was doing there. And, you know, we walked outside and he told me his story. And his story, you know, kind of the fascinating thing about Dennis is that he sees himself, all the adventures of his life. I think he likes to put himself in these crazy situations so he can, I don't know if he's a masochist or something, maybe a sociopath perhaps, but he, you know, a loving one maybe. And I say that lovingly about him, but he's a really fascinating person. He's a man child, you know, he has the same, you know, he's probably just as obsessed with wanting to be as close to Hugh Hefner as he was when he was like 14 or 15 years old. And yet here he is, he's now 83 years old, still living in a van, still trying to find a woman to move in with, still not really trying to make money for himself or do anything else. He specifically wants to take advantage of the fact that, you know, that there are people out there that are looking for companionship, and that's something that he can offer.
Did you find that he's unique, or there are other people like that in the Villages trying, they know at this stage of life, it's like, I got to take advantage of this. And they're looking to do that. They're looking to just find somebody to mooch off of.
That's a great question. I mean, look, I think, you know, a lot of the stories in this film are, in my mind, are unique. And I don't think they're if you were to say, does this type of person exist in the Villages? It's a city of 130,000 people. So I'd say there has to be more than one. that do something like this, that sort of are leeching off the system, so to speak. I'm not sure if it's the same exact way as Dennis, but there are certainly men there who do have a similar desire to play the fields and likely take advantage of women who for their own benefits. Although the thing I find interesting about Dennis is that because he's a relatively self-effacing guy, and every time he lands himself in some kind of situation where he actually is able to move out of the van, the people who he kind of gets together with, they know his situation. So there is this sort of interesting other component to this too, where, some people just don't want to be alone. And there is, Dennis is a handsome guy, and for as patronizing and strange and, unsettling a lot of his comments are, I think there is an attraction that I think some people have to him about, this guy's fun. He's obviously a crazy person to some degree, but he could bring joy to my life. And I think that was at least the case when I met Nancy, who I don't want to spoil the film, but who he eventually is able to shack up with.
At the beginning, you told me how, this place is this almost Truman-like, world, and how it was created to be so perfect and take people into this fantasy world. But as you said, there are all these stories that we hear about life in the villages, that crazy side that doesn't make sense. Did you see that side? Did you see any of that? Whether it's the high level of STDs or drug use or anything like that. Did you see the stories that we all keep hearing?
I didn't. And I will say this, I wanted to find a way to inhabit the space and call the fantasy into question, inhabit the marketing material, the brochure, make, the perfection of the place, how can the kind of this very conservative American vision for, America that never was. But the underbelly, the things that you hear about in BuzzFeed articles, the STD rates, I went to the places where that was supposedly happening, and I never found it. And my feeling was that if it wasn't readily apparent to me, then it's not something I wanted to go seek out. To me, it was less, I'm less interested in the fact that elderly folks are having sex. If anything, that's great. To me, and I wanted to make something that went far deeper and was more concerned with this existential condition, which is, I've bought into this place that's supposed to be a fantasy land. It's turned into a nightmare. I only have about, a few decades, maybe a decade or two left of my life. This is probably the last place I'm ever going to live. How do I find happiness here in a place where everyone around me is constantly, drinking the Kool-Aid and seemingly has found a thing that is so emotionally removed from where I am. That to me was all the more important and I thought poignant in making a film about a world like the villages.
So you filmed this in 2018, and there was not one hint of anything political. And from everything I've read, because I haven't been up there, but everything I read is, this is a big Trump area. But there was also a big divide, because you still have Biden supporters there, and that created an intense divide, a tension between neighbors. But I don't know, when you were there filming, was that starting to rev up, or did you just want to avoid that altogether?
No, I mean, it wasn't a choice on my end of redacting that from the world. What I was referring to just now was the sexual escapades was less on display. To me, the political stuff, in my mind, again, another thing that I never quite found so surprising or unique about the place. I think it's almost the hook of the world of the villages, the way it looks, the way it was designed, the people it attracts, the nomenclature, the way people dress, all of those things to me were so readily apparent that it was of this, it was a deeply conservative vision of what America should look like, would look like, could have looked like, probably never quite looked like. But here it is preserved in this strange simulacrum of the past. You know, the place is so homogenous racially. A lot of these things I thought I wanted to convey visually rather than kind of give true lip service to it. You know, in my mind, the questions of making a film about partisan politics were less interesting to me than something that was more of a, you know, intimate kind of character study of four people who are removed from this, you know, fantasy world. That in my mind felt more timeless.
You're a young fella. And I just wondered, after this experience, how do you view aging?
Well, you know, I think, look, aging is a gift that not everyone gets to have. And I think if you're fortunate enough to get there, which I hope I one day will be, I think you have to realize, and this is something that I certainly realized, that you know, take solace in the fact that life is never quite figured out, no matter what age you are. I think that's in some ways a really despairing idea that some people may find, you know, that all the problems and thoughts and things that you hope will be figured out, and if, you know, you think you'll know yourself more by, you know, age 83. I think that this film kind of shows that that's not necessarily always the case, and that a lot of you know, love and desire and, you know, motivations and ideas of what you want to do with your life, those things never go away. They persist to the very, very end. And sometimes they just will remain unfulfilled. And that, I think, is, in my mind, you know, a fact of life. The thing that's most important is this question and is this chase to become, you know, and to keep moving and to keep growing. And I think I was fascinated by that with the wonderful and beautiful people who let me into their lives with this movie, that these people are all constantly undergoing a metamorphosis, even at age 83. That to me was fascinating. You know, that you may grow older, but you may not necessarily grow wiser, and that's okay.
That was Lance Oppenheim, director of the new film, Some Kind of Heaven. The film is available through local independent theaters, as well as Amazon Prime, Google Play, and iTunes. And you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, virtual orchestras are becoming popular during the pandemic. We'll meet a creator making viral videos who was part of last week's inauguration. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Seasons of Love became widely popular from the Broadway musical Rent back in 1996. 25 years later, the lyrics still resonate. 525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year in a life? How do you measure the life of a woman or a man? You're listening to the recording of the virtual performance of this song that aired live during President Joe Biden's inauguration. Fort Lauderdale native Shelby Rasser was the sound mixer for that performance. As a virtual orchestra creator, she has arranged, coordinated, and produced a number of performances during COVID, including a rendition of What the World Needs Now, and that went viral. Ms. Rasser joins us now. Ms. Rasser, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here. Thank you.
No, it's our pleasure. I wanted to know, how did you get the opportunity to work on, again, it was Seasons of Love and Let the Sun Shine In, Broadway medley that was part of the inauguration celebration? How did you get to be part of that?
Yes. So I have been working over the last several months with this incredible Broadway personality slash radio host slash a million other incredible things that he does. This man by the name of Seth Rudetsky and his wonderful husband, James Wesley. And so I've been producing music videos for their show, Stars in the House, which features a bunch of incredible Broadway performers, and they have television cast reunions and all of these exciting things. And so when the opportunity came up to create a piece for the presidential inauguration, they called me on Sunday at around 5 p.m. for the inauguration that was on Wednesday. And it all just kind of fell into place. And it was the most surreal experience of my life by far.
Not a lot of time to prepare, that's for sure. Wow.
Right, right, yeah.
Tight pressure. Holy cow. You know, I mean, it seems so obvious, right, that the songs that were chosen, very apropos to the moment. You know, you have Seasons of Love, which really makes us think about the fact this past year we've seen so many lives lost to the pandemic. And then, of course, Let the Sun Shine In. It's a very upbeat, you know, song because there's change now. We're going through this change in administrations. But your thoughts on the choices of the songs, I don't know if maybe you would have picked something else.
Oh, I think that the choices of the songs were exceptional. And it's, you know, it's really incredible to look back on this whole journey and see that all of this began with Burt Bacharach and Hal David's What the World Needs Now is Love. And now, you know, being at the inauguration and singing still about the importance of love and the importance of lifting each other up. And, you know, this is such a dark and scary time still. And we're going on almost a year of this. And so just the fact that we can, you know, spread a little bit of positivity and a little bit of hope into the nation where, you know, it's needed so desperately right now. I think that they did such a great job selecting the songs. And it was just really surreal to kind of start with What the World Needs Now is Love. And then Seasons of Love, it all felt so perfect and kind of meant to be in that way.
Help me understand how you organized this. You had all these voices. I mean, Vanessa Williams, Wayne Brady, Rosie Perez, you have people from Hamilton, the show. You have all these performers. How did you put it together?
Yeah, so we had a shared Dropbox folder where all of these incredible performers would submit their material, and Seth and James sent out a piano track for everyone to record along to. So then once they recorded their individual solo lines and the chorus pieces, and everyone was so generous with their time and sending us different options and different versions and different takes and everything. So we had a ton of material to work with. And then Seth, James, and I would jump on a Zoom call every day for several hours and just go through everything and pick the takes that we wanted and kind of lay everything out in a logic session on my laptop. And I just, you know, kind of shared my screen like I do in class or anywhere else. And just kind of took them through the process of editing everything and syncing everything to the tracks while the other band members were recording the other instruments to create a more full sound than just the piano. So it was a very sort of meticulous process, but it was so much fun. And I mean, I've been listening to these incredible artists since I was born, and I grew up in a very musical family and have been in love with Broadway since I knew what Broadway was. So, you know, mixing voices that I've been listening to my whole time, my whole life, was really it left me so speechless. And as you can tell, I'm still pretty speechless to this day.
Well, you know, what's interesting too is, I mean, I don't have to tell you, but it's just that, you know, because of this pandemic, I've seen more and more of these collaborations. And since people can't be together, they have to perform from a distance. And a lot of the times someone would record one piece of it, another person would record another piece. And then you bring all that together, which, I mean, as you're describing it, just sounds so difficult to do. But that's become a popular thing during the pandemic. Do you think that even after the pandemic, that kind of collaboration, that's a thing that we'll still want, that'll still be a popular way to do a performance?
Oh, I definitely think that it will continue being a pretty prominent part of the performance industry in general. You know, it definitely, like you said, does take a large amount of work and is not really something that you can kind of just throw together in one rehearsal necessarily, where a live performance, sometimes you can just show up at the gig, play it once, and that's it. So it's definitely a bit of a more tedious process, but at the same time, you know, I have had the opportunity to work and perform with people all around the world, which is something that I have never, ever been able to do before. Yeah. And that is entirely because it's all remote. And, you know, it's really brought, like, sort of ironically, has brought people together, even when we're all so distant and separated. But I've met new people and I've worked with, you know, my heroes from all over the world. And it's just, you know, it's been unreal. Yeah.
I think it changes the game a little bit. Again, I'm talking with Fort Lauderdale native Shelby Rassler. She arranged and coordinated and produced a number of performances during COVID, including a rendition of What the World Needs Now. And it went viral. And I want to get to that right now. What I find really fascinating, Shelby, about this is, having done theater, having done chorus, musicals as well, you know, it's challenging enough when all the performers are there live. I saw an opera recently that some of the performers were on stage. A lot of them were pre-taped and they found a way to bring that. And it's just like, oh my God, that's got to be really difficult. You did this back in March with this video. Let's play a little bit of What the World Needs Now. It went viral. An incredible video to watch. How many performers, Shelby, did you have for this?
Thank you so much. There were about 75 performers in that piece.
Oh my goodness. So then basically you had each of them perform the song. You had people playing instruments, you had singers. They each performed it, and then you're basically just cutting and editing and adding and moving them around. Right? I mean, I'm trying to picture this. It just seems daunting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I created these guide tracks where, you know, people would load them up to their laptop or their phone, throw on a pair of headphones and play along or sing along, so that the only audio that was recorded was their actual voice or their instrument. And then I just imported everything to my laptop, sort of exactly like the inauguration video, and lined everything up with the arrangement that I wrote. And it all just kind of thankfully came together, and it was a lot of fun, and it was really the first time that I had ever done anything remotely close to anything like this. So it was sort of a learning experience, and I learned a lot sort of on the fly, but it changed my life in truly every single way possible. So I owe everything that's happening in my life right now to that song and that video, and it's something that is so special and so close to my heart. And also, just a quick little fun fact as well, that song, obviously I knew it growing up, and Burt Bacharach is such an iconic figure in the history of music, and I was, you know, sort of reintroduced to the song when Seth and James, who I worked on with the inauguration video, when those two men created a video of What the World Needs Now in honor of the horrific Pulse nightclub shooting that happened in 2016. Yeah. And so, you know, I was able to reconnect with them in that way because of this song. So it's even more special now, looking back on it after all of these experiences with them as well.
Yeah.
And it's just been so surreal.
Briefly, after the inauguration, what is next for you? What are you working on?
Yeah, I'm working on a couple of really exciting projects right now. I'm also a grad student at Juilliard at the moment, so I'm sort of juggling school and and these projects. But since we are on in South Florida right now, there is actually a really special premiere that's happening on February 11th. The amazing Broward Health Foundation commissioned me to write a song in honor of the healthcare heroes. So I wrote a tribute song to all of the incredible frontline workers who are dedicating their lives to making sure that people are getting the help that they need. So that will be premiering February 11th at the Broward Health Foundation's tribute event, and it's at 8 p.m. You could register for free online, and it's going to be a really, really special event. So that's what's coming out next.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. Shelby Rosser, so again, video, she put it together, Seasons of Love and What the World Needs Now, that went viral. But she did the video for the inauguration for part of the musical performance. Shelby, thanks so much, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. So lovely to meet you, and thanks again for having me.
Definitely. And again, perfect song that we need right now. That's our program for this Monday, January 25th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, what is immigration going to look like under the Biden administration? We have a panel discussion talking about DACA and TPS. Also, there's a new stamp from the Postal Service celebrating the Cuban artist Emilio Sanchez. We're going to learn about the profound impact on architecture and preservation of indigenous culture about Sanchez. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.